So, wow, Jeff says, bypassing my various contributions to this conversation. You're standing outside in a bathrobe, and you stink. I can't believe you got wasted for the first time without me. The other day, you didn't care about coming in on me naked in the shower. Now you're judging me in a bathrobe? That was different. This is in public. A crow flies by us, and we smile at the idea of my street being somehow exposed. All that's missing around here are tumbleweeds and those zombies, and a lemonade stand. I got a jet, he says. You know Vanessa. Oh, I was hoping you could help me put in the AC. Nothing. Man, that lady is tough on you. You have no idea. Mom's back, talking through the screen behind me. What are you two doing out there? There's birthday cake to be eaten. It's not even noon, Mrs. R. Well, that's never stopped me before. She has a way of sounding proud about these sorts of statements, as if you can't get to be her size without a strangely American version of discipline, which, let's be honest. Thanks for the cake, I say to Jeff, and I try to twinkle a secret, separate thanks to Amir. We'll see how that plays out. Oh, Jeff says, something else, not from... you know who. It's from me, just so you know who to give credit to. He runs to his car and scurries back with something from the front seat. I hate that Mom's witnessing all this. What the heck? I say, eyeing a small package in a little pink bag. Suspicious, it's as un-Jeff as it comes. It's a regifted bag, he says, his voice cracking, not out of emotion, but out of growing up. But the gift is new. Look at that, Mom says, right over my shoulder. God, does this lady love anything pink. Mom, aren't you busy cutting me breakfast cake? I say, and she does her version of dashing away to leave us alone. Aw, man, G-Force, I say, unwrapping the present. You really didn't have to get me this. Yes, I did. This will be cheaper than the amount of gas I've purchased delivering you messages and, like, cakes. He heads back to the car. I thought you refilled the tank for free at your dad's dealership. Yeah, well, speaking of my parents, he says, you can thank them. My mom insisted I buy you that cell phone. It's been freaking her out not to hear me laugh around the house. What do you mean? Nobody sends me funny text messages anymore, Jeff says. And he starts his Corolla and drives away. So, one more time. You are ruining your favorite black dress because why? We have eaten half the cake already, and it's a big cake. We're also standing at our kitchen island as if by not sitting, we are somehow actively counteracting the calorie load. I want to cover all the trees in our yard with these scraps. This means Mom wants me to. She hasn't been outside for longer than 5 minutes since December. I want us to have a mini forest of ribbons. It will be beautiful. Why don't I just ask Mrs. Devlin for some extra ribbons? I'm sure she has them. They organize the damn tribute. Mom's eyelid quivers. Stupid Quinn. This is the first project Mom's had in a while, and she wants to defend herself, but I can see the words getting stuck in her lips like leaves in a gutter that Dad isn't around to clean out anymore. So I write the line for her. Actually, I say, I can see why you'd want to use your black dress fabric. That way it's more of a personal effort. She breathes again. That's right. That's right. And holds up the torn remains. You want some more cake? I say, side-eyeing the stuff like we're in an abusive relationship. My stomach hurts. My everything does, but I'm also the best kind of distracted. No thanks, Mom says, wiping the corners of her mouth with a paper napkin and smiling big. Do you want to hear about your birthday gift now or later? Wow, maybe now? No, later. It'll give my day a sense of purpose. Really, I'm sort of dying to activate this phone and text Amir. Well, okay, Mom says, pressing her thumb into cake crumbs that have settled into the counter grout. But can I give you a preview? Previews, I say, are my favorite thing. And then I switch to my movie trailer voice, which always gets her.
In a world where movie trailers are better than the movies they are actually previewing, I say. And she giggles and we're good.
Well, I found this stuck between two sheets of Grandpa's old newspaper, Mom says. She pulls forth a deeply yellowed $20 bill. It looks really old-timey, almost like funny money from the Wild West. It's yours, she says, laying it in my palm. And I'm feeling really inspired. I'm going to go through everything in this house and start clearing stuff out and just, I don't know, maybe there's more treasure to be found in this old shack yet.
Or bills to be paid, I mutter, putting my hand on the stack. It is now above my head on the counter, a practically comical sight if you believe that pain is an essential element to laughs, which, by the way, I do.
Happy birthday, my handsome little man, Mom says, kissing me on the cheek. I'm three steps out of the kitchen, wondering what my first text to Amir should be when Mom calls out, "There's Advil on my shelf in the medicine cabinet, Quinn. Don't take that useless store-brand stuff on Daddy's."
I guess I really do stink and look awful, because when I put my foot on the first step, she also says,
"Be careful.
Be careful." I think she means just the general be careful of knowing you're seeing your only son hungover for the first time and don't know how to talk about it, so you'll just give advice on how to treat it once he's safely out of eyeshot. Or maybe she means be careful about other stuff. Be careful about following too many of your instincts, about falling in love with someone who loves you less, about being too wisecracking or smart-alecky or forthcoming with your heart. Basically, be careful about being you. You're only a Roberts, after all.
I will, Ma, I say. I'll be careful. Just as I'm tearing open the cell phone box and slicing an epic cardboard paper cut into my hand. But ignore. Because I am so thankful my new phone is an entirely different model than I or Annabeth ever had. I used to have a Droid. Maybe all I need to be happy again is a new operating system. I don't need any more reminders of the past. My life is all future now. All future, all the time. Watch out. I trudge up the stairs and into my room, typing, "There is half an ice cream cake with your name on it," to Amir. And then I punch in his number from my corkboard and hit send before I can talk myself out of it. My hand is really bleeding now, but then almost right away, I get an immediate response. So immediate, it's not even cool, it's just nice. And it says, "Glad to see you have joined the land of the living this morning. Chase the cake with some Advil. Coming to my party tonight?" I don't have any idea what he's referring to, but also, my hand doesn't even hurt at all. Amir must have mentioned a party to me last night, probably right after I cried in front of somebody for the first time in forever. "Wouldn't miss it," I type. And I smile and hit send at the very same time.
Chapter 20. I'm in our yard, tying one of Mom's black dress scraps to our birch tree, when this hot-looking car pulls onto our street and kicks up dirt and silently maneuvers onto the Devlin's driveway. Yeah, it's one of those silent cars. The little ones that look like they're made in Japan or maybe California. I try to make myself as small as possible, crouching low. Ricky Devlin, it's gotta be Ricky Devlin, gets out of the front seat, and then a small, handsome man gets out too. It's gotta be Juan. I think that's what Mrs. Devlin called him. It's clear Juan has never been to the Devlins. Has any brown person ever been to our block other than Amir? Because Ricky Devlin comes around and takes Juan's hand and starts walking him to the front door. Before they knock, midway up their brick path, Ricky Devlin puts his hand on Juan's waist and has a talk with him. I know the look. Exterior, Devlin's house, day. Ricky Devlin, 30-ish, still handsome, still golden, and Juan, mid-20s, good-looking bartender type, stand outside the house, considering it. Ricky Devlin, "I promise they're going to love you." Juan, "Have they ever met a boyfriend of yours before?"
Ricky Devlin. I've never technically had a boyfriend before. Juan rolls his eyes and nervous laughs. Juan. Oh boy, this could be a disaster. If your mom calls me your friend, I am out of here. Ricky Devlin. Hey, have I ever been wrong before? Juan. Yes, you told me we'd be engaged by now after the last movie premiere. There's a strange pause, and then a pickup truck passes the house and Ricky Devlin backs away from Juan, practically pushing him into the bushes. Juan. Jesus, Ricky. Ricky Devlin. I'm sorry, sweets, I'm jumpy. This isn't West Hollywood. When the truck passes, he kisses Juan, deeply and almost too forcefully. They turn to head to the front door, but Ricky Devlin's gaze lingers on the street, watchful and nervous of being back on this block. Or maybe he's looking for Quinn, his South Hills apprentice. I wait for Ricky Devlin to kiss Juan. I wait to see a truck pass to see what will happen. I wait for the tears to come or the drama, but they don't. All that happens is Tiffany opens the door, looking beautiful and somehow utterly first tier, and she screams Ricky's name and he bounds up the steps to hug her. Their front steps aren't crumbling, they are totally intact. Juan follows, and then, wonderfully, Juan steps up to Ricky Devlin's side, and Ricky Devlin takes Juan's hand and gives it a peck right in front of Tiffany. I hear her give a woohoo kind of siren call. When they head inside, I do too, and as I pass through our foyer, Mom catches me by surprise, bird-watching the whole scene from behind the windows of what, in a normal house, you'd call a sitting room, and in our house is where cardboard boxes go before being recycled. "Well, Ricky sure grew up," she says, still staring outside. "I tied a ribbon for Annabeth," I say, hearing my new phone ring upstairs and brushing past Mom and changing the subject all at once, like the world's greatest multitasker. Chapter 21. Win, hey, it's Amir. I'm gonna keep calling you Win until you tell me not to. Hey, look at me, leaving a voicemail like it's the 1850s. My mom would be so proud of me. For once. Aha. Okay, here are the deets on my party because they just changed and I don't have your email and it's too much to text. The Efron sisters were famous for wry films made before I was born. One of the sisters wrote, the other one directed, and it really worked out nicely. Big box office. Introduced Tom Hanks and a lady named Meg Ryan to the public as that decade's go-to romantic pair. The Efron sisters were cool. They were trendsetters. The Coen brothers don't need an introduction unless you think they do, in which case I'm not even sure I want you listening to this. The Nolan brothers are a different, darker kind of brilliant. I especially admire Memento, which, as I'm sure you know, right, is told in this weird, amnesiac, backward fashion. Starring the kind of hottie who makes bleach blonde hair on a guy seem like not just an interesting choice, but an important one, Memento isn't as tightly put together as you think it is, as you'll see if you watch it 31 times. But then, the Nolan brothers got me to watch it 31 times, so who am I to critique? The Wachowskis. The Wachowski siblings are very awesome. They grew up super working class. One of them came out as transgender, which is amazing and brave. And after the Matrix films, their Cloud Atlas was almost viciously underrated. If I were the type to cry in movie theaters, I would have cried, because the sheer ambition of how they pulled off Cloud Atlas, the most expensive independent film of all time, is astonishing. Great soundtrack, too. Ugh, the visuals, you have to put it on the list. Even the Farrelly brothers of ridiculous old Cameron Diaz comedies, of the Dumb and Dumber franchise, which is a frightening concept on every level, even they had each other. You know what none of the above filmmakers had? A sibling who took off mid-oeuvre. In the old days, Annabeth and I used to ride our bikes to the Liberty Movie House in Mount Lebanon on Sundays, even though it was on this slightly sketchy strip. The Liberty used to be flat-out majestic, and if you blur your focus, it still is. There are stars painted into the ceiling. There is an Arabian setting painted onto the walls. A popcorn and a Coke is $4 total. And I guess some local donor keeps the place going because he's a huge and reclusive old movie buff and supposedly lives in, like, Pittsburgh's version of a mansion. "Where's my birthday boy off to?" Mom says, discovering me as I'm reaching for the door to the garage. "I think I'm going to ride to Mount Lebo and just see what's playing at the Liberty." "Should you look up showtimes first?" Mom says. She shifts on her feet, uneasy. Mom is from the generation of people who believe that no event can occur unless they have seen it listed in the paper first. "Nah, I like to be surprised." I give her a quick peck, especially on my birthday. I disappear into the garage, to the land of humid exhaust. It's the weirdest thing. We haven't had a car parked here for, exactly 6 months now, and yet it still reeks of exhaust. Maybe this is how Annabeth is haunting us, through clouds of hot gasoline. "Will you be home in time for supper?" Mom's holding the door open, not quite letting me go. "I thought I might cook you something for your birthday. Something special." I hit the garage button so that the extremely noisy retracting door drowns out and minimizes the impact of my bad news, of my lie. "Aw, Ma, Jeff is taking me out for my birthday." "Tonight he is?" she says. "Yeah, yep." If I were Pinocchio, my nose would have poked out Mom's eye by now. She steps into the garage. The overhead door is still opening, and it's louder than ever. A dad would, like, WD-40 it or something. "Here," Mom says, handing me another 20 and shouting over the screeching machinery. I hate to make her shout. "I keep finding money in Grandpa's old stuff." "What's this for?" I say, trying to play sweet. "There's a pharmacy on Washington Road, past the post office and before the Presbyterian Church that is a mockery of its former self." Mom hates to see a religious institution fall on hard times. The garage door is finally open. The only sound now is us. "The pharmacy," Mom continues, "has a whole section in the back with beauty products." This is nice. She wants me to buy her some stuff for a makeover like Annabeth used to do on her. But no. "Pick up some new cologne before your big dinner thing tonight," Mom says. And her eyes dart away, and then she does. Chapter 22. Exterior, Liberty Theater, day. Quinn stands on the street outside the theater. His bright white teeth shine and then seem to blink, and we see why. The Liberty's exterior is decorated like the 1940s movie house it is, the best kind of old-fashioned that feels not old but instead timeless. The colorful lights reflect off Quinn's teeth. He steps up to the ticket taker, an ancient man, Ed, picture your favorite grandpa, whose back is hunched but whose eyes twinkle like the Liberty sign above. Quinn. "Ed, my man!" Ed.
"Quinn, my boy! It's been ages! Where's that freckly little sister of yours?"
Quinn's smile somehow doesn't fade. He remains brave for Ed. Quinn. "Ah, she's actually my big sister, Ed, and she's not here anymore." Ed looks confused the way Quinn's mom does when he tries to explain how to erase stuff on the DVR. Ed,
"She went off to college?"
Quinn, no, that would have been next year. I mean, she died, Ed. Annabeth's no longer with us." Ed exits the ticket booth, walks slowly around, and gives Quinn a paternal hug. He is in a very heavy sweater despite the summer heat. When he pulls away, neither guy is crying, they are both strong. Ed,
"Stay here."
Quinn,
"Where are you going?"
Ed,
"To talk to the projectionist."
Ed walks with great determination toward the wide double doors, edged in beautiful brass buttons that lead into the Liberty lobby. Quinn: What for? Ed: Today only, back to back, Forrest Gump, then The Wizard of Oz, then E.T. if I've still got it in the back. Quinn looks up at the marquee and laughs. Quinn: But it says you're playing the Poseidon Adventure, Eddie. Ed: Not today, we're not. Ed's eyes water. Now he's not strong. It's beautiful. Ed: Today, we're only playing her favorites. Quinn gets choked up. He coughs into his hand. Ed: And little brothers get in free. He holds the door open for Quinn. I hope Ed's working today. He is so grumpy and sweet. Old guys are the best. I hope I get really old and wear scratchy sweaters and treat obviously gay kids like they're extra special. It's been a while since I've been to Mount Lebo, and when I cross the street, I don't even bother locking up my bike because who the hell is going to steal a mongoose on a Sunday? Maybe I'm feeling overly optimistic about the 40 new bucks in my pocket or about the day of movies ahead before Amir's temporarily going away party tonight. And I guess what I'm saying is, I am feeling so good, I catch myself off guard when I hear the word no, before realizing it's me who's saying it. Ed is not working at the Liberty. The Liberty is not even open. There's a big sign placed over one of its beautiful old window cards, which once displayed vintage movie posters and now has these giant red letters. For rent, contact Jennifer Jen Reichart at Reichart Realty. And I am thinking two things. One, no, this cannot be fucking happening. Two, Jennifer Jen Reichart, way to go with the highly original nickname. I'm standing and staring and staring, and my raspberry iced tea is working its way like a chemical-fueled speeding train toward my bladder, and finally, a homeless man, who is lounging in the shade of the marble entrance of the theater, goes, "Bummer, right?" He's the kind of bum where he probably actually had really good parents who wanted big things for him, and he is slowly making his way across the country till he can live in Portland or whatever. What I'm saying is, he's not far gone. He's actually kind of cute if you squint, which I am, because it's sunny and I always lose sunglasses. "Is it, like, closed?" I say. "Yeah, like 6 months ago." "Well, what happened?" The homeless man sits up. I like his shirt, like, a lot. This is my life. "The old dude died." "Ed?" I say, stupidly. "Don't know names, bro. It was the guy who, like, funded the theater." You can't ask a crazy person to explain anything, and so don't ask me why I am tearing down Jen Reichart's real estate sign, but I am. As if by pulling it down, the lights will flicker back on, Ed will take my ticket, I'll have a place to pee, and be. "Of course," I say when I see it, the ad for the last movie that played here. "The Wizard of Oz," I say out loud for the homeless man, or maybe for myself, or for my sister. Her second favorite movie of all time, after E.T. "The best movie ever, shut up, shut up, shut up," she'd say when I'd make fun of her for such an obvious choice. But you know what? She was right. Her favorite films, Forrest Gump and E.T. and The Wizard of Oz, were sappy and sincere and actually not quite perfect. And so was she. "We're not in Kansas anymore, Toto," the guy says. He chuckles and leans back. And the crazy person, being played by me, goes, "That's not the line. Everyone gets that line wrong." The correct version of the quote is in my top 10 favorite movie quotes, in fact. I take a step toward him. I lean my hand against the box office glass, and I realize its windows are now wholly papered with flyers for moving companies and babysitters and lost cats. I begin tearing them all down.
"Chill, you're harsh, bro."
"It's just if you're going to quote a famous line, you know, get it right," I mutter. But I guess loudly enough to piss the guy off. And so when he gets up and starts toward me, I think he's going to lunge or something, but he doesn't. He just smiles a little and juts his chin out as if using it as a pointer.
I believe somebody is making off with your bike, Toto, he says.
He has perfect teeth. I was definitely right. His parents had big plans for him.
I turn around. Two kids half my size have found a way to board my little mongoose together like a circus act and are jamming away with it down the street. I drop all the paper advertisements and take off after the little punks. Just as I make it out of the frame, tripping past the Quiznos that has the best raspberry iced tea and feeling my stomach gurgle, one of the flyers, advertising a candlelight vigil for a local girl killed in a car accident 6 months back, gets swept up in a manufactured breeze that has been added by a set decorator simply so that this sequence ends with a visual flourish. The flyer blows directly into the screen of the camera, cutting to the next scene.
Chapter 23. Quinn Roberts's Top 10 Movie Quotes. Number 1. A boy's best friend is his mother, Psycho, 1960. Number 2. As God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again, Gone with the Wind, 1939. Number 3. Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night, All About Eve, 1950. Number 4, I Could Have Been a Contender, On the Waterfront, 1954. Number 5, Keep Your Friends Close But Your Enemies Closer, The Godfather, Part 2, 1974. Number 6, I'll Be Right Here, E.T., 1982. Number 7, Toto, I've a Feeling We're Not in Kansas Anymore, The Wizard of Oz, 1939. Number 8, We'll Always Have Paris, Casablanca, 1942. Number 9, What We've Got Here is a Failure to Communicate, Cool Hand Luke, 1967. You'll notice there's no 10th. I'm still waiting to happen upon it. I suppose that's just the kind of guy I am. Whimsical. Chapter 24. It's an amazing thing when two prepubescent kids on a mongoose bicycle built for one can outspeed a full-grown, nearly adult teenager, but there you have it. I am stuck in Mount Lebanon without a ride home, without a movie to see, with too many hours to worry myself into the overwritten version of what tonight's going-away party for Amir is going to be like. I'm not ready for him to leave. He just arrived. My, people come and go so quickly here. The Wizard of Oz, 1939. I get out my new phone to text Jeff to come pick me up, but the contacts aren't synced yet, and the only number I have memorized is my mom's landline, which hasn't been connected for months. So when I stomp past the old Presbyterian church, I figure I may as well make the most of my misery and stop into the family-run drugstore to pick up some new cologne, Mom's gift to me. Look at me attempting optimism again, twice in 1 week, new world record. I'm in the beauty section thinking maybe this will be the summer I bring CK1 back when, Mr. Roberts, I hear, and I'd know that voice anywhere. What up, Mrs. Kelly? So weird. She is wearing pristine white sneakers and a t-shirt, and I can barely wrap my head around seeing this totally buttoned-up Republican anywhere but in her cinder block counselor's office at school grilling me. Well, here we are, she says. In a screenplay, we sometimes write in the word beat when we want an actor to take a purposeful pause. Imagine a lot of beats here, because finally, she goes, you look fantastic, Mr. Roberts. Oh, thanks, I say. You, look the exact same. You haven't changed. I've been working my tail off at the gym. Mrs. Kelly tucks a strand of hair behind her ear. I've lost maybe 20 pounds since the last time I saw you. Oh, geez, I say. I was kidding, Mrs. Kelly. You look amazing. Please, Mr. Roberts. If an entire face could do an eye roll, hers does. I've been married twice. I know when a man is lying. Mrs. Kelly is holding some kind of nutrition powder in a bulk container, and the weight of it seems to be making her arms shake,
What kind of gym could she possibly be going to if it has not prepared her for the weight of a jar of powder?
Can I help you with that? I say, and I put the CK1 down, and she hands the powder to me and, with no discernible segue, goes,
There's still time, you know. I haven't legally been allowed to reach out directly, but as your counselor, I am as committed to getting you into a good college as I am the next student.
Thanks, Mrs. Kelly. Let's see what happens, I say. I've never liked school. Nobody in my family has ever finished college. Why upset the apple cart?
I've been looking into getting my GED, and I was thinking about getting a job, so stuff is definitely on the horizon.
Mrs. Kelly bypasses my words.
Have you gotten any of the packets I had your teacher send home? You really can start senior year right on track.
I keep picturing what it would feel like to drive past the pug every day, to pull past Annabeth's dog face and see the school flagpole, which will, no doubt, be permanently at half-mast as a tribute. Kill me now, as if homeroom wasn't tragic enough already. My phone rings. No idea who it is, but it's local.
I should get this, I say, handing back the protein powder, which was, by the way, heavy as fuck, my bad.
It's an important call.
Where is her mean face? Where is Mrs. Kelly's judginess? She is being so kind and patient. She's frustrating me.
Of course, she says. I step away and swipe to talk.
Hey, I hear.
Gee, hey, you have my new number. Cool.
Yeah, I got you the friggin' phone, Jeff goes. I had to pretend I was you at the Verizon store.
Are you coming with me to Amir's party tonight?
He sighs. No. Just to remind you, he and I aren't really friends. He was just using me to get you cakes and love notes.
Okay, so what's up?
Let's meet up, Jeff says. In person. I have to show you something.
Something bad?
No. He does this weird pause, like a suspicious beat.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, I say. Can you pick me up on Washington Road in Mount Lebo, actually? I got here and then some kids stole my bike.
Quinn, your life story is starting to turn into a documentary that people would walk out of because it's both too sad and too slow.
Fuck you, I start to say, but I realize Mrs. Kelly is only an aisle over, and suddenly I want her to like me.
Well then, I say instead, can you show me this mysterious whatever tonight, like after Amir's party?
Fine, Jeff says. And just when I'm about to say, and can you maybe pick me up from Station Square late? He goes, figure out a way to get to my house, and hangs up. I check the time on my new phone and realize I should put some work into making myself as hot as possible for later. I feel an incoming missile zit situation coming on.
Mrs. Kelly, I say, walking too fast down the aisle and nearly running right into her. She's been spying on me, I think, hiding behind a tower of sympathy cards. But I don't care. In fact, I like it. I feel cared for.
Can you give me a ride home?
Mom is in the sunroom. She's hugging a pair of Mickey Mouse ears. Teeny tiny Mickey Mouse ears that Annabeth got on our one family road trip to Florida. I can tell Mom's been sorting through everything. The house is even more turned over than ever, with piles of newspapers and old Life magazines pulled up from the basement, and she's asleep and lightly snoring, which is normal. But she's doing something else at the same time, something headline-making big. Local woman found smiling for longer than 3 seconds in a row, click for video. I look to the counter. The postcard advertising men's haircuts is gone. She started going through the mail, finally, like some kind of grown-up. Sometimes it's hard to not think of Mom as a kid herself. Technically speaking, she's an orphan now, and she isn't married. I'm kind of the only thing left that makes her seem like an adult by default. One of the lights flickers off in the kitchen. I hope she pays the bill soon. Chapter 25. We have this local train thing called the T in Pittsburgh. It's our rickety mass transit system and our version of an above-ground subway. Everywhere else in my life, I like complete control, but whenever I'm on mass transportation, the T, like tonight, or an airplane once to Charleston for a choir trip, I'm actually okay with giving over, with letting the pilot steer. I don't know why. For the record, the best train scenes of all time are Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, 1989, The Bridge on the River Kwai, 1957, and, duh, Strangers on a Train, 1951. I'm not looking these up, by the way, I just know the dates. Can you imagine if I could apply this kind of memory to something genuinely useful? The Sunday night tea schedule is usually unpredictable, but tonight we're going particularly slow, and I really can't be late to Amir's party. Apparently it's on a riverboat, and we are traversing one or all of Pittsburgh's three rivers, and it's a whole thing. I only know I have to be there by 7 p.m. sharp, according to his voicemail, which I have listened to so many times that I have started taking the little breaths that he takes along with him when I re-listen. "Ladies and gentlemen," I hear from a speaker mounted directly behind my head, making me hop out of my seat and nearly smash into some lady's granny cart. "Because of an incident near Station Square, the T will stop before the tunnels, with free shuttle buses directly to Station Square. This will cause an approximately 10-minute delay in schedule." Well, this is ridiculous, and I'm about to say as much to the other passengers when this guy in full pirate's regalia goes, "This fucking blows," and starts kicking at the doors of the train car. He's really quite violent about it. You can see actual dents forming in the metal. And now he's talking to the granny whose cart I bumped into and trying to loop her into his anger. And as I'm watching him, I realize I don't want to be that kind of guy. The one who ropes people into his fury. The one who makes fun of his wife's cooking for how it always disappoints him. The one who never watches a single one of his kids' 5-minute-long movies. I don't want to be that guy. "This is our last and final stop. Please board the shuttle across the street." And so I choose not to be. "Does anyone know where Amir is?" I say, pacing around the launching dock off Station Square, right at the edge of the river. Pittsburgh is so pretty. People think it's not going to be, and then it is. "I don't think he's here yet," somebody says. I'm looking and looking for Carly, hoping to see a familiar face, when a girl in a skirt goes, "Pepe Le Pew!" And I realize she and I were on the team of non-natives in the celebrity game of Doom. "Oh, hey," I go. "Cool glasses," she says, and I touch them like I'm Cinderella, like my fairy godmother put them on for me, which I guess she did. A horn from behind me, "Honk honks!" followed by the half-hearted cheers of a group of people trying to look cool. There's so little that people get openly worked up about. A few folks stub out their clove cigarettes, and I see one guy swig from a Dr. Pepper in a brown paper bag. And then a faceless voice calls out, "All aboard!" It's him, Amir, jumping out of the back of somebody's car and holding Carly's hand. It makes my stomach shimmy seeing them touching each other, and I like that I feel protective about a guy for once. Usually I'm the only guy I feel protective about, huh? I try to get Amir's attention, but he and Carly run around onto this old-fashioned riverboat called the Good Ship Lollipop. A line forms after them to get on, too. These three girls in front of me are guffawing at something on one of their phones, and when I turn away from them, that's when I notice giant floodlights. The kind in stadiums, but also the kind used on film sets. The kind you'd set up if you were shooting a movie on a Sunday night that disrupts the flow of the tea, which causes a kid to decide to not react like his dad would, and to hop on a shuttle bus to a going-away party for a boy he was just well, getting going with. My phone buzzes.
Go to the upper deck, mister, the text says. I'll find you.
Already, the floodlights are making me dizzy.
Chapter 26. Pittsburgh routinely falls into the top 10 list of places you should live. Fun fact, I haven't visited many places, but Pittsburgh is my favorite city regardless. It's in my blood. I have never been west of Ohio, but someday I want to go to Chicago, maybe. I hear it's like a big Pittsburgh with better pizza, and the lake there is like a small ocean without sharks, which sounds perfect.
It's like so nice up here, some girl says, leaning over the railing on the upper deck of this overcrowded riverboat.
And it is nice. I just wish Amir would find me before I'm forced to make small talk with some rando.
At least the captain of the boat tonight has us going at a full clip, which feels like something. Every time we go beneath a bridge, the captain idles the engine and everyone on the boat lets out a giant cheer and our voices multiply like bats flapping around in a cave.
I pull out my new phone and debate text options to Amir. On the roof, with an Amir-sized hole in my conversation. Or just, on roof, dot, dot, dot. Or just, if you find me and bring me a drink, I will act responsible. The last option makes me smile, and as I'm typing it out, I feel hot beer breath on my face and look up and let out a tiny shout. And then I go, hey.
Happy, Amir says with this weird little break in the sentiment.
Birthday. He looks really good.
Thanks for getting down here tonight. Was it a hassle?
No, easiest thing ever.
Someone brings Amir a drink, and he says thanks, but when she turns away, he pours half of it over the side of the ship.
I laugh. Why are you doing that?
People give you so much crap if you don't get shit-faced, he says. So I just keep pouring half of it out. I feel responsible for everyone's safety tonight.
He hiccups. He is actually a tiny bit drunk.
Did everyone arrive at the boat pre-liquored? Is that a thing?
Did I make a total jag-off of myself last night, I say. I'm looking at Amir's cup, and rather than coveting it, my stomach is playing pinball.
Nah, you were sweet, he says.
Great. Sweet is how you describe a toddler.
He goes to touch my hair, but the boat hits a wake, and he stumbles a little, and so to cover for the awkward moment, I change the camera angle on our conversation.
Oh, there goes the incline, I say, pointing behind Amir.
We have this really cool train that climbs the side of the mountain in Pittsburgh up to this restaurant called Le Mont, which means the mountain in French, and it's fancy, you have to wear a sports coat, and Jeff's parents treated me and Annabeth to dinner there once, and we didn't know what to do with all those forks.
Oh man, I'm gonna miss Pittsburgh.
Close up, back to Amir.
Well, how long is your writing program thing?
Amir puts his hand on my waist and it feels wonderful.
Do you remember what I said last night after we bowled about my, going away?
Oh boy, I could fake this, but my timing is off. In my mind, I was going to stand here and reenact a whole funny Le Mont montage about how Annabeth and I used the fork to brush our hair like Ariel in The Little Mermaid, and so I'm caught too off guard to lie.
Only kind of, I say.
Amir sits us down on an ancient bench whose wood gives almost as much as a pool floaty would. The good ship Lollipop is like half an iceberg away from disaster.
So I'm not sure I'm coming back to Pitt in the fall, Amir says.
Yeah, I definitely don't remember him saying that because I'm standing up again and chugging my 7-Up down fast, and I'm not liking this one bit.
Where are you going then instead? I say.
I put my foot up on the bench like I'm posing for a Dockers ad. Idiot.
I got into this pre-MBA business program back at UT, he says, running his fingers around the rim of his red plastic cup.
It's a good opportunity. I mean, it would shut my parents up at least. They sort of threaten not to keep paying for Pitt, so.
Do you want to go into business? I say.
No, but I'm feeling a little driftless in Pittsburgh, and a lot of my friends are in the program at UT.
By the way, I like your cologne, CK1.
You have me, I want to say. I know we are good for each other.
You mean aimless, I say, and he gets up and places his hand on my knee and goes, what?
And I say, driftless is not a word. And Amir chuckles and says, I don't understand how you're not a good student. You are smarter than me.
Then I am, I say, and we laugh, but I'm not really laughing. I'm panic flirting, convincing him with little sonic eye rays to stay here. To stay in Pittsburgh and teach me things and keep telling me I'm smart, I'm smart, I'm smart until I believe it enough to get out of bed even on days when I have nowhere to go and nobody to collaborate with.
The song of the summer comes on over a jerry-rigged speaker system. Amir skids his hand over my buzz cut and it makes me shiver. I want to ask him what he sees in me. Why are you even hanging with me at all, I'd like to say. But somehow the letters switch themselves around, the little rascals, and all I manage to get out is, was this boat expensive to rent or what? He makes an offended face, but I stand my ground. I mean, it's not cheap, he goes, but it's fine, it's no biggie.
Okay, I say, pulling my knee away from his hand and feeling antsy.
It just seems like a really big thing to be doing, to, like, rent a boat to give yourself a going-away party when you haven't even been in my hometown a full year.
Wow, all right. I mean, I made good friends. I wanted to send everyone off in a big way.
Could you say the first and last names of everyone who's on this boat right now?
I know he can't. I know it.
Amir fake laughs and puts his drink down on the bench.
You threw up on my shoe last night, mister, he says.
I look down. He's got these bright cream-colored Adidas on, and indeed, there is a tan stain across the toe and bleeding into the shoelaces, like the fallout from a dropped casserole.
Whoa, I'm so sorry, I say.
It's okay.
I guess Amir is a good starter guy. Throw up on him, try out some theories, say goodbye. Except I don't want to even wave goodbye.
Have you ever dated somebody as young as me? I say, and Amir goes, oh, are we dating? And I go, oh, no, I mean, I didn't mean that. I meant theoretically. He goes, no, all of my boyfriends have been a lot older. And I'm thinking, all? When he adds, and if I dated anyone younger than you? And he takes my 7-Up and puts it on the bench. I'd have to get paid babysitting money.
I instinctively lunge for the cup, and when I come back up with it, Amir takes my chin with this wonderful kind of too much force and brings my lips to his.
This isn't how I wrote our first kiss. And yet. His tongue is inside my mouth, and it is simultaneously bigger and wetter and also more delicious than anything I've ever eaten. I can taste him, I mean, and our teeth bump, and I'm not sure if I'm doing it wrong, but when he laughs, I know it's not a mean laugh.
A little less tongue, he slurs, which was precisely the note I was going to give him.
When we go at it again, I'm giving him, like, no tongue, and he pulls away and goes, the hottest thing about you is you don't know how hot you even are yet. He pulls my waist into his, and the song cuts out, and somebody goes, look!
A riot of fireworks launch into the night sky, lighting up Amir's glasses in confetti green bursts. It's not the 4th of July, because my birthday is in June, and goddammit, it's still my birthday. And for one brief, odd moment, I consider whether Amir ordered fireworks for me or maybe for himself.
Burst, burst, burst! The sky is trying to break apart. We both look up.
Did you, wait, like, arrange these for my birthday? I ask.
The hot metal bridge, which we're idling under, looks rusted to oblivion, like it could collapse on us. And so suddenly I want to get away, out from underneath this dare.
When? Amir goes.
Yeah? I said, no, I don't know why fireworks are going off. Maybe for some sports thing? But nothing's playing tonight. If a game were playing tonight, the tea would have been littered with more angry people, just like that guy I don't want to be. Now the night clouds are red, and now they're purple, and now they're yellow, and yet the giant kaleidoscope sky feels smaller, somehow, than Amir's tongue in my mouth, which is happening again. Smaller than the fact that his mustache zone is scratchy enough to be making my lip burn. Can I say something risky? Amir says, pulling away and hiding a hiccup, and I go, anything, quiet and quick, and he goes, I think we need to get you laid tonight. And now the sky is yellow, yellow, white, 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 the finale, bombs bursting in air like something not quite patriotic, but rather peculiarly crass. My choir trip to Charleston coincided with some national holiday, and when we landed at the Pittsburgh International Airport, it was nighttime, and as we descended through the clouds, we saw about 20 different displays of fireworks happening across all the flat regions and towns that dot Pittsburgh's edges. I was the only person on the plane from Charleston that night who wasn't in awe of the fireworks, but rather was thinking, one, I hope we don't get hit by a stray firework, and two, if I survive this plane ride, I need to remember this imagery so that someday I can use this scene in a screenplay. So I guess that's a no, Amir says, about getting you laid. He throws his head back to drink from his red cup, but I know he finished it more than 10 minutes ago. I know because I saw him chug the rest of it. I am distracted by seeing everything, and so instead of telling him that getting laid tonight sounds negotiable, possible, probable even, the most unique 17th birthday present a guy could want, I am suddenly watching Carly, who's woozily trying to keep her cool as she approaches Amir from behind. Mir, she says, salty, like he's been ignoring her all night. The captain dude guy wants to know if you want to head back now or in 10 minutes. Amir swings around. What are you talking about? I rented this thing for like a whole nother hour. Carly juts her pointer finger into his shoulder. Beer sloshes against the sides of her cup like when you cannonball into a hot tub. Don't shoot the messenger, she says, her inebriated sentences turning all vowel before our very eyes. The engine below revs back up. The boat begins a creaky turn back toward those weird floodlights at shore. Amir looks at me and goes, stay here, and then gets close and whispers, and cut Carly off. And when he's gone to the lower deck, my arms get pin-prickled with wet river air. In the hazy firecracker smoke, Carly almost looks like Jeff. Hey, I go, do you know why your brother is pissed at me? Forget him, Carly goes. Let's talk about Quinn and Amir, huh? As if he and I have formed a law firm. How is Amir even affording all of this? Oh, baby, Carly says, adjusting a bra strap and smacking her gum. His dad is like megabucks. Oh, no shit? Yup, I basically set you up with a prince. Wait, literally? Carly scrunches her eyebrows and shouts to top the rainbow-colored rockets above. No, Q, not literally, literally. Oh. Anyway, even princes are human. He had his heart broken this year. Be gentle with him. I lean in. Actually, Carly, I say, making her play my older sister in a surprise moment of stunt casting. I think Amir wants to have sex tonight. Literally, I spell it out. If I say the actual word, I'll be 1 inch closer to it, and it intimidates me. Wait, this is amazing, Carly says, dancing in a little circle, which seems to dip her even deeper into the well of drunk. That is like an opportunity, Quinn. Loud, too loud. Amir is like experienced. I try to blink away the most recent firecracker. Well, we'll see. Don't we'll see me, kiddo. Is he not the hottest? Did I not set you up with the hottest? He's hot, yeah. The hottest. Don't let me down, Quinn. Wow, I was actually kind of hoping she'd back me up here. Tell me to wait until I feel ready. How do guys even have sex together? I mean, I've seen the videos, but how does it not, like, hurt? Sorry, serious question. I lean my hip against the railing, right into my bruise from the bowling alley table. Carly, you brokering my virginity is kind of freaking me out, to be honest. Quinny, I just want you to live a little. I look back at the incline, wishing I were on it. I don't know, I say. And then I pull out my secret weapon, my magic trick, the ace to beat all hands. The whole situation makes me feel guilty, you know, because Annabeth never got to kiss anyone. Carly says, okay, into her beer, like she and the foam are in on a secret. And I pull the cup away from her lips, and over Carly's, hey, I say, what? Thinking she's being funny or something. Thinking, I don't know, maybe Carly and my sister practice kissing on each other once. Nothing, nothing, Carly goes, doing a tipsy thing my dad used to do where he'd have a secret, but he